coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody and happy Tuesday night. I hope everybody is doing well amidst the madness in the world. It's madness out there, man. Not only in our shores, but out of our shores. We are on the verge of all kinds of things. Because of all that, as typical, our second guest is always topical, folks. So we'll be finding some people to talk about this stuff going on in the world for our second guest slots coming up during the end of this month, beginning of next month. Next week, do not forget, stop on by the Mineshaft Saloon in San Antonio, if you are out that way, to visit the Symposium of the Strange. We will be out there with Nikki Folsom next week doing People of the Fae. We are all of a week away from that event, so stop on by and check that out. She'll be talking about fairies, myth, fact, all kinds of fun things. In the second part of this segment tonight, folks, after our commercial break, we'll be joined by our good friend King Gerhard. His new book, The Essential Guide to Mothman and Other Flying Humanoids, is out, which is kind of a re-release of an old book that he put out years ago, with all kinds of new case file and data, things like that. So that's going to be super fun. Also super fun, this weekend is the official release of Gulf Coast Great White Sharks, Return of an Icon. This event, this awesome documentary put on and put together by our good friend Chester Moore, as well as researcher Paul Fuzinski, will be going on at the Museum of the Gulf Coast in Port Arthur, Texas. I cannot wait to go out to this. Welcome back to the show, Chester Moore, and welcome Paul for the first time. How are you guys doing tonight?
Great. Doing great, man. Talking sharks with my friends tonight, so this will be fun.
Right. It's been awesome to see you develop things, especially everything that you've had going on over at Gulf Coast Great Whites. You jumped on the story of Lee Beth like a rabid dog when it happened, Chester. I remember it was like you had a website up within half a day. It was you were on this story from the get-go. And as we had you on the show whenever you launched the Gulf Coast, the Gulf Great White Sharks website. And like I told you then, growing up in Houston, the Bay of Yoo-Hoo, as we called it over there, you knew there were sharks out there. You knew there were some, maybe some tiny reef sharks, things like that. But you never really considered, of course, growing up watching Jaws, you couldn't see in the water. So there was always just this reticent fear of like, my God, there's a massive shark out there. But my God, there are massive sharks out there. So let's go to Paul first. Paul, how did you first come to the world of wildlife research, conservancy work, and how did you come to meet Chester?
It was just something that I was interested in when I was 25, graduated college and hopped on the Appalachian Trail and spent 6 months out there doing that whole thing. And then it really got interested in, wildlife and the outdoors in general. And I started, researching all this stuff about hunting and fishing and, kind of like living off the land kind of stuff. And that brought me to wildlife conservation. And long story short, I ended up meeting Chester at a wildlife conference. And we have been great friends ever since, and we've made many wildlife documentaries together. We've traveled all over the United States. We've been to Yellowstone. We've been out to Colorado, Rocky Mountain National Park. We've been to Boston filming this great white shark stuff, down to Texas a million times, and it's just never a dull moment with the Chester Moore.
Yeah, he is constantly out in the field, this guy, and his work speaks for itself. I mean, of course, Chester runs Higher Calling Wildlife. He is a reporter and photographer for Texas Fish and Game. He's the host of the award-winning, numerous award-winning now, podcast Dark Outdoors. So so happy for you, man. That's great. And you know, it's one of those when you live your life in the outdoors, it's interesting to see something like this pop up. How much of a surprise was it to wildlife researchers out there, guys, when they found out that apparently not only were great whites like Liebeth out there, but had been out there, and that there are numerous?
Well, it's a really interesting story, Chris. And if you look back, even in older books that I have from, like, you know, the 60s and stuff, and I collected, I would go to old thrift shops as a kid and pick up all the wild. I'd find older books, and it would show the range of the Great White Gulf of Mexico. But there was a lot of controversy whether there were still any out there. Mm. And then right around this time, exactly 20 years ago, my friend Captain Ryan Warhola gives me a call from a satellite phone. He's a charter captain. He was an 18-year-old charter captain at the time, 60 miles off Sabine Pass. And he says, Chester, I'm in a rig, and I need to know the difference between a Mako and a great white's teeth. Now, a Mako up to 7-8 feet next to a great white at 7 or 8 feet look pretty similar. They're in a similar branch of sharks. And I said, a Mako has kind of jangly teeth and a great white's perfect triangles. And they got quiet. He said, Chester, I'm looking at a 15 to 16 foot great white. And that began an investigation. And I wrote an article for Tide magazine that year called Jaws in the Gulf. And it won an award, but it was very controversial. The editor got some nasty emails saying that's fiction, blah, blah, blah. Although I had old reports going back into the 50s of great whites. But a group called O-Search started putting satellite tags in great whites back probably 12 or 13 years ago now. And they started popping up around on the Gulf side of Florida. So they're up all the way up to, like, you know, Panama City, Pensacola. And so it proved they were in the Gulf. But when Liebeth popped up last year, she was tagged by a group called the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy based out of Cape Cod. And she was tagged by Bim, my friend Megan Wint, Dr. Megan Wint, and Chip Michaelove from Outcast Sport Fishing. She was tagged December 8th, 2023, out of Hilton Head, South Carolina. By February 26, 2024, she was 100 yards from the beach at South Padre Island.
Wow.
And made history. She dipped into Mexico for a while in that water, and then she came up the coastline. And by March 7th, my friend Ryan Warhola, who saw that great white and put me on this journey, sent me a screenshot of her position on the Atlantic White Shark Sharktivity app. And it said, just to think they thought we were crazy 20 years ago. This is right by the rig I saw the great white at 20 years ago. So
wow,
you're right. As soon as that happened, I knew it was game on for what I've been working on for a long time on great whites. And it was time to sort of really do a deep dive on this for the sake of conservation of that great species.
Well, and especially when it comes to conservation, things like that, there are huge efforts in the Gulf Coast as far as reef conservation. I have a good friend from high school who worked with Texas Parks and Wildlife for years in the reef conservation program, going out and dropping new reef structures, things like that. So the idea of repopulating the area in that kind of way to bring, larger fish populations in closer, that's been something that the rigs have been for years and years, is artificial reef. That's typically, if you're taking a decent fishing charter out or something like that, that's normally where you end up going to catch large fish.
The northern Gulf here is kind of the west northwestern Gulf is pretty devoid of natural structure. Not a whole lot of it out there. I mean, we have the Flower Gardens Marine National Sanctuary, the Stetson Rocks, and some other stuff. But so a lot of those artificial structures actually help propagate fish. But what's interesting about white sharks being a migratory species is they're finding out, these researchers, that they're hanging out most of the summer up all far the way up is Canada. And then they'll move through, and then a lot of them end up in the Gulf in the winter. So they don't like the really, really extreme cold as much. And then they don't like really hot either, so they'll kind of come down. And it's been a really fascinating ride because and Paul and I really had a very specific talk about this when we put this documentary together, is that this is a very symbolic thing, because I can tell you, man, the Gulf has a lot of redfish. People go, okay, cool.
Yep.
I can tell you there's even marlin out there and some high-end fishermen that get excited. But when I tell you there's great white sharks out there, the whole world wants to talk about it. So that's really what me and Paul were talking about. And Paul, while we're doing these interviews and stuff, I remember at the end of one of my interview segments with a man named Dr. Greg Skomal, he asked how much sport fisherman dollars for projects like you paid for. You want to tell that little story right there?
Please, Paul.
Well, yeah, my whole thing was, you know, a lot of this, there's just this weird conception that, you know, hunting and fishing are bad and they do all this stuff. But when in reality, it funds the majority of conservation work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I just had to ask, I'm like, you know, how much of this work is funded by hunters, fishermen, whatever? And it's a pretty big portion of his work is funded by, you know, an offshoot of the conservation dollars coming from fishermen. So it's just, you know, really interesting stuff. Every time you turn a corner with this stuff, you learn new things, and it's just exciting in general doing any conservation work. But I mean, come on, it's great white sharks. You can't beat that.
Yeah. Well, and especially on the anniversary of Jaws coming out, things like that. And like you were mentioning, the idea of conservation work, especially making such a difference to being funded by fishing licenses, things like that. That's something that I've told people about for years and years, is proper hunting, regulated fishing, things like that.
Sure.
Actually do amazing things for the populations, because at that point, yes, the money coming through from tagged fishing, redfish tags, things like that, go toward the Coastal Conservation Association. They go to replenish redfish populations, things like that, make sure that the conservancy for those are there. And it's kind of like we've said numerous times having you on the show, Chester, and even with our guest King Gerhard afterward, if you love Bigfoot, if you love things like that, get involved with conservation. Can start conserving the land where they live. If you love great white sharks, if you love these other animals that are in the ocean, get involved with the Coastal Conservation Association across the country.
Because it's hugely important. And you brought up a great point there about proper, like very proper conservation. That's what happened with great white sharks. So researchers have learned that it takes 25 to 30 years for a white shark to reach sexual maturity. Wow. So, and they have a handful of young. So it doesn't take long when you start targeting those big fish to wipe out a population. They believe the Atlantic populations, with the Gulf's populations intertwined with the Atlantic, that it was down 80% in 1997 due to scientific research and learning all this. They started protecting great white sharks. And you started seeing comeback because it was illegal to harvest them. It's not sustainable. It's not a sustainable harvest. Redfish, which put out millions of young, millions of eggs. And so that became a thing. And they also removed a lot of gill nets along the coast, which were probably catching a lot of the younger white sharks moving in. So science kind of led the way in conservation. Now you have groups like the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy and others that are doing wonderful work on OSearch and others, trying to raise awareness and do a lot of this great scientific research. And get, you know, I've said this in every media appearance I've done on this, and that is that if you hear about the Gulf in national or international media, it's either a hurricane or an oil spill. I want people to look at the Gulf as a very vibrant, important water body that has incredible biodiversity. And there's no better symbol of that. And there's no better time. I interviewed Lewis Pugh last week. Lewis Pugh is an endurance swimmer who swam all kind of environmental swims he does. He swam back in May. He swam around Cape Cod, the whole thing. And, and to raise awareness of great white sharks. And he said, this moment with this one of the most iconic films of all time, the 50th anniversary, this is a once in a generation opportunity to talk about this topic. So I knew when it was time to work with someone who had the intestinal fortitude and can keep up with me. Paul was the guy to go do this with because of his heart for conservation and his talents as well. And I knew this was a moment. And here's the thing. This is the first ever documentary about great whites in the Gulf. Now, I'm sure on Shark Week this year, they'll debut something on Animal Planet, but that'll be great. Yeah. We beat him to the punch by a few weeks here.
That's right. That's right. By just a little bit. Now let's start getting into that. Paul, what was it that begat? Because you do quite a bit of, not that Chester doesn't do a lot of field work, things like that, tons of field photography, that kind of stuff. But you specifically do quite a bit of documentary work, things like that for your outdoor work at Aptitude Outdoors.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, I don't have the scientific background to study these animals, you know, professionally. I don't have a biology degree. I don't have, you know, the hard science background that it requires to do all that. But somehow over time, I've just been getting better at filmmaking and filming, and I have a real passion for filming wildlife. It's definitely difficult, which draws me to it. You know, these things move and they're hard to focus on. And for people like me and Chester who have probably extreme ADHD at some level, it's very fun to film these animals because you're constantly moving. And, you know, just being outside is one of my favorite things. So, you know, just trying to build a life around that is awesome. And to, when someone calls you, I don't care what you're doing, if you're at a job or you're at a whatever and it says, do you want to go film great white sharks? You don't say no to that. Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You fire me. I will go. See ya.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's once again, as I was saying before the show, it's kind of like whenever my buddy was like, you know, I got somebody that could set you on fire. I was like,
yeah,
I'm not going to say no to that. That is a unique opportunity.
And yeah, I probably have a few people that want to set me on fire, but we'll
not in the nice, let's put it on film kind of way, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I found myself over the years in this like producer's role in a lot of stuff because I'm good at bringing people together, things together. And it was started in music. I just noticed that our bands were independent, but didn't really have a producer. And I was the de facto producer. You know, just because I was there and could put it all together. And that's when it came along with this. And there was a moment where I was invited up to the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's Media Day in Cape Cod and made a connection. And they told me, man, we're so grateful you came up here. We'd love to get you out when the sharks are really here. I was there a little bit early for shark activity. And I called them back like a week later. Were you serious about that? Can we put dates on the calendar?
Yeah, yeah.
And oh, Paul, I'm like, you want to go film great whites? We went up there and spent 4 days with them and filmed at their shark center, and which is an incredible place, and got to go out in the field while they were doing a drone study of great whites. And it was a pretty incredible time. And, you know, Paul is so good at capturing the feel. And that's always important to me, like the feel of what's going on there. And, you know, I'm looking out there and there's like this, probably 200 seals on this beach, you know, and the captain of the boat goes, there's going to be sharks. He said, why? He goes, there's only a couple of seals in the water. They know something. And then like the other seals were like, they were clueless. And the dudes on the beach, you could kind of see them going, hey, shark. And they're like, huh? You know, like, you know, those guys ain't going to make it. And it was just like a fun thing, but it was it was really incredible. I mean, and it was a moment for me because, Chris, you know, all the work we do with youth and children, and we have three of the young people that we work with in our documentary with key roles. That was something I had to have. I hate when you hear about like, let's get the next generation involved and no one ever shows the next generation doing anything. You know? So we did that, but I had realized as I'm looking, there's a great picture on Paul's Facebook right now of me and him hanging over the boat. I have a GoPro. He has a camera. There's a great white. You can't see it in the photo, but it's like 10 feet away from us maybe. And I'm realizing I had now seen great white sharks for my cage dive in the Pacific in 2002. Now I'm in great whites in the Atlantic. And this was from a little boy who saw Jaws and watched Jacques Cousteau ocean specials and dreamed of one day being able to see this. And part of what we want to do with this documentary as independent filmmakers, as independent journalists, is to let people know that if they have that dream in life, if these two knuckleheads can make it happen, they can't. And that was an important part of this, to open, to make a wider tent for anyone who wants to get involved in conservation. And, you know, you can't escape the Jaws part of this. And I was not leaving the freaking Cape without going to Martha's Vineyard, where we had Jaws filming. And there was a very powerful moment. I know Paul will remember this. He captured this. We're leaving in this gigantic, I mean, huge ferry going over to Martha's Vineyard, like a 45-minute ride. And look back, kind of tucked in the under these beautiful oaks out of Woods Hole there. Sign says Oceanographic Institute. Well, on Jaws, when Richard Dreyfuss' character, Matt Hooper, walks up to the scene, he says, "Hey, I'm Matt Hooper from the Oceanographic Institute on the mainland."
Yeah.
I was looking at the real one they reference on the mainland from Martha's Vineyard, which is Amity in the movie. And it was a cool moment. Got to film a little clip that's in the dock over at the Jaws Bridge, a famous bridge scene. And it was interesting because I believe in the long run, not the short run for sure, but in the long run, Jaws has done more to raise the profile of sharks and great white sharks than anything. Even the younger kids. I mean, they like the Meg that came out a few years ago and stuff like that. But Jaws still has its place. And there was a lot of people who wanted Jaws on their walls, including me when I was a little kid, you know, after seeing the movie. But people like Dr. Greg Skolmall, we interviewed, said that character, Matt Hooper, actually inspired him. And it was a part of inspiring a lot of other people. So I think that's another important part of looking at it from this perspective, you know. And Paul was not a Jaws guy growing up. So he got to see it in reverse. What was that like for you, man? I mean, you kind of saw it in reverse.
When we went to Martha's Vineyard, I had still embarrassingly not seen Jaws. So Chester's freaking out, and I'm like, it just seems like a lot of old people getting drunk. That's what I saw.
You're embarrassing us in front of the scientists, dude.
yeah. But after the fact, it was really cool to like see all that stuff. Like, oh, that's where they filmed that. And I mean, just from a filmmaking perspective, dear Lord, that movie is amazing. I was blown away by the whole thing. And even, you know, being as old as it is, and it still holds up to that level of like cinematography and filmmaking, that blew me away. I mean, it's considered probably cheesy by today's standards at some level, but I mean, it's a good movie. You know, I came home and watched it because Chester's like, "You got to watch it if we're making this documentary." I'm like, fine. He wins. It was a good movie.
it was one of those, like I said at the beginning, and I've got a picture up here from the Chronicle in Houston that shows, as I said earlier, the Bay of Yoo-Hoo. And granted, you know, this is just like suspended silt in the water, folks. But this is what I grew up with whenever it was like, hey, let's go to the beach. You know, it's not like crystal blue water, things like you get down near Corpus Christi, that kind of stuff. Absolutely. The wash is totally different. You aren't there with like three major rivers. But that whole area of the Gulf Coast that is being tracked by the tracking app and everything is quite literally that whole area is Bay of Yoo-Hoo. So the idea of not being able to see that directly under the water when it's there with you is frightening. And as a kid, you know, it was one of those, I was telling my barber the other day, like, man, Jaws had me scared enough to not want to swim in Lake Livingston. like you know, that's fresh water, Jack.
Well, you know, my dad talked about he used to wade fish up to here to throw his surf rods out for bull reds. When Jaws came out, it was knees for him.
Yeah, I had one instance where I won't wade fish anymore in Galveston or anything like that because of it, because I had a small shark tug on a redfish that was attached to my floating
one. Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was there close enough that I could hit it with my club and knock it away, but it was just a tiny little black tip, you know. Only a couple few feet long, but enough for me to be like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to be in the water with them. I'll be on the shore. Yeah. I'll be
but that's part of the safety part of this too, actually, is, you know, like Atlanta White Shark Conservancy, their whole thing is, you know, that safety part of Cape Cod, because there's a lot of great whites on the beach now. They have a whole system that they do, which we got to witness in person. Mm-hmm. And their Sharktivity app, we literally saw a great white. And then Victoria, the girl there, the lady there who was doing part of the drone study, sends a message to the people on this beach, and then a purple flag goes up with a great white logo on it. So we saw that in action, and I give, because this is a, they're not out to get people, but they do hit people sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, in general, you know, people freaked out because a great white showed up. I'm like, your chances of ever running into a great white on the beach, but you got a big chance of running into a black tip or a spinner or a bull shark. Yeah.
And if
you're out the beach a lot, I guarantee you, you've had a bull shark swim pretty close to you at some point. And last year, there was a bull shark attack at South Padre, and the media went nuts. People were blaming the great white that had showed up. And of course, I did a blog at Gulf Great Whites and said, well, she would have had to make a one-day trip from Nova Scotia, because that's where she last pinged a couple of days ago. But the funny thing is, the media can't handle reporting on wildlife and sharks. They take it to a new level. A publication in the Rio Grande Valley posted that Parks and Wildlife had essentially lassoed the bull shark that attacks the people and had taken it and let it out to deep water to get it away from people. Now, I'm thinking, this is Texas, and a lot of things are possible, but that sounds like a tall tale. So I called Parks and Wildlife, and I'm going, they did not publish that. I said, yes, they did. and so they went out there and made them correct it. But, you know, in general, shark safety, if anyone listening out there, if you're wade fishing, I highly recommend don't use the kind of old school thing like Chris and I use, where you have the one little float and you just kind of put the stringer to the mouth.
Use
the baskets. The baskets are a lot better, and you need to have as much distance between you and the basket. Another thing is, if you're in the water and a bunch of bait fish come up, you find yourself in a school of menhaden or mullet, time to go bye-bye. Get out of the water.
Yeah.
Because there's sharks feeding in there. Other thing is, you mentioned murky water. Now, when you go into the Galveston Bay, like Sea Rims, Upper Coast, part of Louisiana coast where I live, all this area – murky is a relative term. So, you know, if you got visibility like this, like, you know, if you can see down 3 feet, that's clear local water.
Yeah.
But if it gets real murky, stay out of the water, because sharks won't be able to see you, and they just might hit because they see something move or you know, a little bit movement or smell fish around you or whatever. And don't swim at night. Because the bigger sharks and stuff a lot of times move into the beaches closer to you know dusk and dawn and stuff like that. Just basic safety, intelligence stuff. I recommend a thing called a shark bands that puts out a signal from the Earth's magnetic.
Oh wow!
That has shown some resistance to sharks. I've had it on an episode of Dark Outdoors before.
Interesting.
So I just want to throw a little bit of safety stuff for the Gulf Coast, because most people never run into a great white.
Yeah.
You know, the fear of sharks is interesting, because I get it in the water. I understand that. But I had someone I was talking to who was almost shaking talking about sharks. I said, you do realize they're not going to ring your doorbell and like show up at the house, right? So the good thing about a shark theory don't go in the water if it freaks you out that bad. But you don't have to be terrified of living in Beaumont, Texas.
Yeah.
30 miles from the Gulf. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, especially when it comes to that kind of education, you know, once again, I think that was brought about a lot in Jaws. It was interesting because they did, the character, from Woods Hole did do a lot of education on behalf of sharks, you know, letting people understand, like, no, like, great whites aren't man eaters. That's not really what they do. It's not really the prey that they're after. We don't like if they bite us, it's more maybe an exploratory bite, something like that. And once they realize there's not enough fat content, hey,
yeah,
you know, and
pretty
even the idea of, like you said, bull sharks, those are ones that they are reported a good 30, 35 miles up the Mississippi. There's one currently wreaking havoc in the Potomac.
Yeah.
In the Potomac bull River. Sharks,
there has actually been a bull shark that was verified in the Mississippi in Illinois.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty crazy. Now, you mentioned all that educational effort. This book was an important part of my childhood, and it sold a bajillion copies. And there's a couple that were involved with the cinematography underwater of Jaws, Ron and Valerie Taylor. And they actually took all the first video and photos of great whites underwater. They took, including that shot right there.
Wow.
But talk about the power of images. When I think great white shark, immediately the coolest photo ever taken pops up in my mind. That's what I think of. I think of a great white. That shot by Ron Taylor.
Yeah.
And you know, I look at that and go, that's the coolest thing in the entire world. Some people may have a different reaction.
Yeah.
But how you present the image is important. I think we did that well in the documentary. We didn't make them seem like they're a bunch of hippie vegans with gluten-free sandwiches trying to go for an oceanside campout. They are no. great white, for God's sake. Well, but
I was going to say, let's get into that real quick, Paul, especially as somebody who, you know, once again, was not necessarily a shark enthusiast growing up or through your conservancy work. What was it like for you to step into that role as a filmmaker and really document that side of it, the effort for conservancy? And what were you trying to, at least as somebody who may have had their own personal revelations as this journey went on, what were you trying to get across with the film?
Well, I think most importantly is that, yes, sharks are dangerous, but I mean, every animal is dangerous if you're an idiot, I guess.
We're like, pretty dangerous.
I mean, humans are the most dangerous. That's something Chester and I talk about quite often. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just about being smart. I mean, there's so few shark attacks that it's really just media blowing it up. And I think it's really important to remember that you are responsible for not getting attacked by a shark. I mean, if there's, you know, you talk about Boston, there's no joke up there. You go on the beach and there are signs. I would say, what would you say? They're probably 10, 15 foot wide by 8 foot tall on the beach. Giant, bright red signs that say there are great white sharks in this water. You are risking your life when you go in there. If you ignore that, that's your problem, dude. Like they're doing everything in their power to make sure that you're aware of what you're getting into. So I think a lot of this stuff is blown out of proportion. And just like Chester had talked about earlier, it takes them almost 30 years to mature to be able to have babies. And they can only have so many at a time because they're, I think when we interviewed Dr. Megan Winton, she said they're 8 foot long when they're born or something. They're just massive.
Five feet at birth.
5 feet. So, I mean, you know, you learn a lot about these animals in real time, but then, you know, the moment everything came together for me is like we, you know, with Chester, when a lot of the stuff we do, it's like a 3-4 day gauntlet. You know, he calls me up and says, hey, I booked a flight for you. Meet me in Boston. I'll pick you up at the airport. We meet up, we drive, we BS, we catch up, we get to where we're going. We get to the hotel, we wake up, we got to do a couple interviews. We set up, blah, blah, blah. It's just rush, 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 rush. And then all of a sudden we're on a boat in the middle of the ocean outside of Cape Cod. And I'm just in filmmaking mode. So I'm filming everybody on the boat. I'm trying to film the airplanes flying overhead. I'm trying to film everybody doing their thing on the boat. And they said, oh, there's a shark. We're pulling up. So I screw on my attachments to be able to see in the water. I'm hanging off. I'm filming this shark. And then I look like I'm in the camera, and you would understand this working with cameras. Yeah. I'm in the screen looking at it, filming it, making sure it's in frame. And my eyes focus past the camera and then I'm like, that's a great white shark. Like, holy crap, that is a real massive great white shark. And I am on a railing, basically walking the plank out here. I'm 6'1", so like this railing's below my hip. And I'm like, if this boat rocks, I'm dead. Like, you know, I look like a pretty good SEAL. So it's just, it was very, you know, it was very cool to see that in person.
Yeah.
And then awesome. To learn from these people about the shark research that's going on, like the current shark research, a lot of the stuff we're hearing, you know, a lot of the stuff that they make on television, they make it fast, but some of the stuff's years old. Like if they're doing reruns from Shark Week, that's, you could, that could be 10 years old. That's old information. We're learning about new things. And it's really interesting. They don't know where sharks breed. Like, to me, that's just crazy. Like, how do you not know that? They have trackers on tons of these things and they just don't know what they're doing. And it's like in an age where we all think we know everything, and an age where we all think we got it all figured out because we have the internet. We still don't know about these amazing animals. And, you know, yes, they can be terrifying, but also they are a species at risk. They're very dependent on very specific things. And it's a real thing that we have to be concerned about. And luckily, you know, you can't fish for them anymore. And that stuff's really important. And as a person who's an avid fisherman, you know, you advocate for that, because if it's harming the population, then why would we go for it? You know what I mean? And all that stuff is very, very cool to learn about. I wish more people would learn about it. And it's kind of funny. This is probably the only podcast we could really make this make sense. As Chester and I were talking the other day, we're like, you know, great whites are kind of like the only like cryptid adjacent animal that's out there. Like, cause like they're clear. Like we see them all the time. They're on TV all the time, but it's like, that fear that campers get at night when they're around the campfire telling Bigfoot stories, people get that when they go in the ocean. But like,
for sure,
it's funny that they're, it's like, you know what I'm saying? Your audience is the only one who would understand that. Yeah. You talk about that with a bunch of biologists, they're going to be like, well, don't talk about this.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it does take sometimes that suspension of disbelief to get a point across. And and you know, it's one of those once again, the idea that a 2-hour long suspension of disbelief known as Jaws led to the beginning of Shark Conservancy, basically, is really fascinating to think about. It when you look, especially in the world of conservancy, there is what is known as an indicator species, and when you're talking freshwater, things like that, like frogs are a huge indicator species as to whether or not there are toxins in the environment, that kind of stuff, that may further affect fish and other things because they feed on the tadpoles and on the frogs and that kind of stuff. And sharks are very much an indicator species in the world of oceanography, you know, and in marine biology. Go ahead, Paul.
It was interesting that you brought that up, because I did not know. I mean, this is just could be ignorance on my part, but you know, I grew up in the Midwest where we have, you know, we have deer, you know, that's what we have around here, raccoons, squirrels. They didn't have any seals up in Massachusetts, up in the Northeast at all. And they basically had wiped them out because they said the fishermen were saying they were like depleting the fish populations. And then, you know, talking with the scientists there, they believe that's part of the reason the sharks weren't there for so long is because, or in, at least in lower numbers, because seals are their main food source up in that area of the world. And they're still kind of figuring out what they eat in the Gulf. You know, I think they said it might, some of the, correct me, Chester, some like sea turtles and some of the like redfish and stuff like that, they're eating some of these bigger fish. But up in the Northeast, it's seals, and the recovery of the seal is the recovery of the great white in that region. It's all, you know, preach ecosystem all you want, but I mean, habitat destruction and collapse of ecosystem is the number one threat to all wildlife right now. It's not hunting. It's not this. It's
yep.
And with that, with, you know, the seal comeback was, it's its own thing. I mean, that could be an incredible documentary. But when Jaws came out, of course, the initial reaction was very negative. I mean, there's a lot of sharks killed after that.
Yes.
And interestingly, the man that Captain Quint was inspired by was a fisherman named Frank Mundus. And it wasn't like exactly like Quint, but he was a, you know, kind of a character. And he, I forget what he mainly fished for. It might have been billfish or tuna. In the fishery had tanked, and he caught a big great white and hung it on a dock, and the newspaper showed up predating Jaws. He was going out and doing this, and he get, you know, just massive fish they caught. And then by the mid 80s, when Mundus had seen what had happened, and also Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws, they became staunch shark conservationists. So I think, you know, sharks, it's interesting because Jaws is not what painted a bad picture. We prove it in the documentary, by the way, that Jaws wasn't what put a crosshair on great whites at first. There's Mundus right there. Yep. And I have a newspaper clipping that Paul does a great job of showing in the documentary from 1950 when a great white was called a man eater in a Texas newspaper.
Mm.
And there was the movie done with Ron and Valerie Taylor and others in 1971, 4 years before Jaws, called Blue Water White Death. And it's on Prime. It's incredible to go watch.
Huh.
And so, but Jaws took it to like a global level and a lot of fear. But out of that, these young shark conservationists rose up. And now we can go at the 50th anniversary and look at the people that are put their eyeballs on great whites because of that. And I think it's a net gain in the long run for sure. And I think it's a fun thing to celebrate because, look, think about this from the environmental perspective. I mean, you got like Free Willy or something, but like, let's look at reality. You know, come on, let's look at reality here. Name a movie that's, or a picture like that, anything like that, that has a little bit of, Jaws is pretty reality based. I mean, there's, you know, that makes you think about nature like Jaws.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe a river runs through it or the book, but nothing like Jaws puts the attention on a species and an ecosystem. So we are honored. As brothers in conservation and doing films together, to release it on the weekend Jaws was released 50 years ago, and help steward that next generation of conservationists. I was talking to one about 7 o'clock this afternoon, Marina Wilson, who is one of the stars of the documentary. She's a first-year marine biology student we're working with the last couple years. And
cool.
She's going to host our event. She's going to be our event host. And we've got my friend Erica Shea here from Orem Burrell, and then Ridge Petty, two other young people in the documentary. And we're seeing a new generation rise up, and they're wanting to do something positive. And we're going to be announcing some positive conservation things out of this and doing our best to say, hey, you know, the true apex predator of the Gulf isn't the bull shark, and it isn't the hammerhead. It's Carcharodon carcharias, the great white shark. And we want to put that stamp of conservation awareness with filmmaking, you know?
Absolutely. And Paul, you know, what are you looking to, I guess, what are you looking to bring to the next generation with this? How are you looking to present this to them? And how are you hoping that it will help bring a new generation to understanding this animal?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's really important that, you know, we understand that these opportunities are available to people. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, on National Geographic. You don't have to be a world famous filmmaker that makes $10 billion a film or whatever to do this stuff. Like Chester and I did this on our own because we care about it.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have any funding from anybody. We didn't have anything, you know, provided to us. We just went out and did it. If you're passionate about something, you really can just go for it. And, you know, maybe it's not going to be, you know, the most amazing looking shot on the 12K camera with a 30 person film crew, but you're telling a story that means something to you. And I think that's more important than anything. You know, we don't have a lot of fancy equipment and a lot of, you know, technical knowledge about a lot of things, but we work really hard and we're passionate. And I think that's what's important for kids to know, especially in this age of social media where everybody seems to be famous all of a sudden, all the time, out of nowhere. And, Chester and I live in the real world. We work hard and we try and get a message out there that's positive in a lot of negative stuff. And I mean, that goes for wildlife too. There's so many misconceptions about wildlife. People are just confused. They don't understand it because we're not in touch with wildlife anymore. I mean, it's rare for people to be interested in wildlife and nature and the outdoors in general anymore. And I think it's just bringing people any way possible to bring them closer to the real world, which is, you know, nature. And I think that's really important, and just letting them know whatever they're passionate about. If they want to be a marine biologist, filmmaker, journalist, podcast host, whatever they want to do, they can do it for whatever they're passionate about. Hopefully it's wildlife from my perspective, but if not, they can do it, man. We're just dudes. Absolutely. We're out here just doing it.
That brings up a huge point that we try to champion on this show all the time, and that is the concept of citizen science. I am a backyard astrophotographer. I am out there looking at the night sky all the time. Like a good 10% of astronomic objects and discoveries are made by people like me who just have the time to observe. You know, and it's fascinating to see, A, how many relict species have come back, things like the ivory-billed woodpecker, stuff like that. And that's only through people who have the time to observe. Now, granted, there are people like y'all that are out there in the field doing this stuff. Chester, once again, works with, Texas Fish and Game, things like that. He's out covering bighorn sheep relocation all over the country, things like that. So when he reaches out to somebody, it might be a little bit different level, you know. However, if you're somebody out there with a big footing on the weekend and you have trail cams out in a dense wooded area, feel free to get with your local wildlife conservancy. They would love to be able to count bears with that, count birds, all kinds of things. And you're now contributing to their science. You're building a bridge. And come the day that you need something examined, they're going to look at you in a different light because you've been contributing to them.
Wasn't there a Bigfoot group doing a camera study out in California, and they found a species of marten they thought were extinct or something recently within the last couple of years? I remember hearing about that. I mean, real people.
No,
the people out in the woods are the ones with the cameras looking for stuff. They could find species that they didn't know exist.
Possible. No different than the fishing guides out there that are out there in that water all the time, you know, to be able to take pictures. That's how Lee Beth
got tagged by a fishing guide with the Atlanta Whiteshark Conservancy. And it's a great thing for that on-ramp you're talking about for people to be involved. And, you know, I just knew we had to do this, so I dug in and figured out how I'm going to fund it out of my own budget here. Then I went kind of the backwards way. We did independent production, and we had afterwards, we had the Texas Outdoor Writers Association through our friend Herman Brune and Rebecca Jones and the Church family step up and be contributing producers and help us fund some of the promotion of it and buying bulk footage. And we had some other people sign on to help. But there's ways to do it, like crowdfunding and stuff as well. Well, we did it in reverse because the opportunity was there, and we knew that this was a moment in time that will never repeat itself. And we owed it, I think, to ourselves, start off with, just to take advantage of this for the sake of conservation. Because, look, we can talk about white-tailed deer all day long. We can talk about snakes. We can talk about ducks. But man, when you start talking about sharks, you get people listening, and we want a wide audience, cast a wide net, and hopefully make a big, big impact. And what Paul so eloquently said about, like, people can have a chance to do it. Don't worry about all what you see other people, the illusion of celebrity and all that stuff. If you got the heart and you got the talent, put some work in and make great things happen.
Yeah. And you know, it's amazing because as a technician, things like that, like, man, there's a Blackmagic app for your camera now that literally lets you control f-stop and, like, use your camera like an actual photographer and filmmaker. You know, it's fascinating, and that thing is free. So the fact that, like, you got a 4K camera in your pocket that you can then use that app and shoot footage and get even shoot in raw format for editing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's pretty disgusting. It's like, that's just ridiculous, man. Because you've already got the technology in your pocket. And that's kind of something that I used to tell people whenever I spoke at podcasting conferences, that kind of thing. It's like, you don't have to have, I've got a ton of technology, but it's also what I do for a living. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I make music. I do all this stuff. I've been in broadcast for years. I do corporate AV for a living. So I have tons of technology, but when I went live on the way into my son's birth, in like from the waiting room to the surgery room, I just had an earpiece on. That was it. I wasn't even live on video. I was live on audio, and that was it. It was just a hardwired earpiece to my phone. You do not have to get complex to make the content.
There you go.
You know, so yeah, the idea of get out there, get your hands dirty, do it, make the dream a reality and release it into the wild, much like any well cared for critter that you are trying to help sustain in the world. And go ahead.
No, I agree. I would say that's one of the hurdles I see with a lot of people is they'll make something or they'll want to work on something for years and years and it's never perfect. And I'm like, at some point, guy, you just got to let it go. You just got to send it. Like, you know, I was telling Chester, I sent him the final documentary last night and I was like, I could sit and nitpick this thing to death for 5 years, but it's as good as it's going to get for the time frame we have, and it's ready to go, and it's watchable, and it's the best thing we can make in the window, and I think it's important. Yeah. You got to give yourself a deadline and just go. Do it. Put it out there. You can make other stuff down. I can make so much crap every day. I can make stuff forever. And something I regularly do that I enjoy is like with this trip with Chester, I'm coming down there. I'm not bringing any of my nice cameras or anything. I have a little Sony pocket camera, and it's just sometimes it's good to go back to your roots with your cheap equipment and just see if you can still make good stuff with it, because you can. You don't need expensive equipment.
No,
it's all BS.
Yeah. It really is one of the, there's all kinds of fancy hammers out there. And then there's one with just a wooden handle. Like you don't need a tuning fork inside of it and all kinds of things, but it's out there, you know, and the idea of one of the things my wife's always mentioned about me and my music is that I actively enjoy listening to my music. And I tell her I enjoy listening to it because I don't toil over it. I had friends for years that when they went to make an album, like they, and granted, I don't do a lot of vocal singing, things like that, but still, I don't toil over it. When it's done, it's done. And it may be done rapidly. It may be done in about 6 months, something like that. But I release on average at least an album or two a year, something like that, because I don't toil. I don't make it a chore.
That's a great point, and I mentioned this. So the metal band Overkill, it always ends up going back to metal somehow.
Life is
Bobby
metal.
Blitz from Overkill, Bobby Blitz said, look, man, we're not artists trying to convince the world and beg the world to understand our artistic dialect. We're craftsmen. We have a certain skill set. We do our best and put our product out. And that's kind of all this is about.
Well, and exactly. And the idea of conservancy for conservancy's sake. You aren't trying to, once again, you didn't go out, you didn't raise a crap ton of money to get this done. You didn't go out and find a crap ton of sponsors and angels and that kind of stuff and go through insane channels of promotion to get it into a Regal Cinema or something like that for a day viewing, that kind of stuff. You went to the Museum of the Gulf Coast and said, let us help you help us, you know. That true idea. They've been
great partners.
Yeah.
It's a very prestigious museum. It's a 19,000 square foot museum.
It's a big museum.
And a great place. And they're great at hosting events. And the fact this was Gulf centric, it wasn't just made by somebody on the Gulf Coast. It was about the Gulf Coast, was, I think, very important to them. And they built a cool event around it. And we're doing a lot of media. And we're so excited to meet everyone that's going to come out. We've got it's going to be a lot of fun, man. We're going to have, it's for the whole family. It's free. Two showings of the documentary, and get to hang out, see us, and learn about sharks. And I'm going to do a little presentation before the doc debut called The Jaws Effect. And, I mean, you think Chester Moore is going to be on the day Jaws was released 50 years ago and not talking about it? You're out of your freaking mind. So, I'm going to have that little talk before we go. And then we're going to take this shark and let it go out into the water. And, hopefully it doesn't attack anyone.
Well, I am.
Well, maybe a few people.
That's fine. Yeah. Hopefully it at least nibbles some toes and gets some good attention.
There we go.
Because truly it is important, once again, for science to have just in the last little bit come to the realization that the Gulf Coast is actually a massively important, basically nursery for great whites. That, like, this is where they come to spend part of their adolescence. you know, things like that, is fascinating research. And once again, just coming to the world of marine biology. So it changes things. It changes how we look at things here in the Gulf. It changes how we treat the waters that we're fishing regularly, things like that. So thank you guys for the effort, for A, seeing the necessity for this and actively making it happen. Because once again, people can take pen to paper and start putting a documentary together, but to actively, I remember once again, it was not long ago. It wasn't even a year ago, Chester, that you launched Gulf Great White Sharks. So at gulfgreatwhites.com. And it was probably a few months after that that you were like, me and my buddy Paul are starting a documentary about this. So it's been within a year that this was conceived, shot, put out. So congratulations, guys. I am hugely happy for y'all. Before we let you go, Paul, let everybody know where they can go to like, follow, subscribe, where they can go to find everything that is Paul Fazinski.
Yeah, you can just go to aptitudeoutdoors.com. That's where everything that I make goes. I'm on social media. I'm not a big active social media guy, but I am on there. So it's Aptitude Outdoors on everything. And, you know, I'll be posting about the shark stuff and my trip down there at the museum helping Chester. So if you want to find me, you can reach out there.
Fantastic. And Chester, before we let you go, where can everybody go to keep up with everything that is Gulf Great Whites? And where can they go to keep up with everything that you do with Higher Calling Wildlife? Where can they go to get their tickets for this event? Are there tickets for this event? Is it just come to the museum, buy your admission?
It's come to the museum, but the first 100 families that come get a commemorative movie pass. And they also get a commemorative. There's only 100 of these printed up. I was there, Gulf Great Whites decal.
Nice.
And lots of cool stuff like that's free. GulfGreatWhites.com, all of my great white stuff. By the way, GulfGreatWhites.com was named by the Excellence in Craft Awards by the Texas Outdoor Writers Association, number one outdoor website of Texas this year.
Wow.
It was just also recognized and by the Press Club of Southeast Texas as one of the top three blogs. Of course, the funny thing is Higher Calling Wildlife beat it. So fourth year in a row, highercalling.net by the Press Club of Southeast Texas, number one blog by them. Highercalling.net is kind of my catch-all for everything that I do. And at the Chester Moore on Instagram. And if people go to gulfgreatwhites.com, they hit the subscribe link, and they send me their mailing address, I'll send them a Gulf Great Whites decal. We have sent out, Chris, in the last 3 months, over 600 of these to people subscribing to the blog. Wow. So things are happening.
Fantastic. I'm so, so glad to hear that, Chester. It's always great to have you on the show. I love your work. I love what you do. Paul, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's always great to meet new conservationists that are out there trying to save our outdoors. Because once again, whether you're a hunter, a fisherman, whether you're a cryptid researcher, these are places that we need to preserve. If we like the wildlife, if we like the cryptids that we're trying to track, we first have to start with protecting their homes and protecting their environment. So congratulations, gentlemen, and kudos to everything that you've done with this documentary. I can't wait to see it.
I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you for always being a staunch supporter of the work I'm doing, and also for having so many people across different parts of this outdoors world, whether it's cryptids or whatever, on your program. Thank you for being you and having us on, man.
Absolutely.
Yes, thank you very much.
You bet. You guys take care. Have a great evening. I'll be sending links, everything else, very soon.
Sounds good.
All right. Take care, guys. While you are online checking out everything from gulfgreatwhites.com as well as Higher Calling Wildlife, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can also find your link to Curious Research. If you have had an experience of the paranormal, stop on by, fill out our experiencer form there. let us know what happened to you, how it happened, things like that. When we come back from this break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend King Gerhard. We will be talking about his new book, The Essential Mothman, The Essential Guide to Mothman and Other Flying Cryptids, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to our good friend Chester Moore. I cannot wait for his upcoming Great White Shark documentary at the Port Arthur Museum. It's going to be great. I'm going to be there. You should be there too. Our guest in this segment is the amazing King Gerhard. He has just put out a new and revised version of a book that he previously had out, the Essential Mothman and Other Flying Humanoids. This is a great, great compendium. If you are into the world of Mothman, into the world of flying humanoid, like, believe it or not, folks, there are more flying humanoid sightings than you can shake a stick at. There's quite a few that you may not be aware of, and it is fascinating information in here. Welcome back, Ken. How are you doing?
Christopher, it's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you, my friend. How are you doing today?
Doing great. I have been thumbing my way through the new book. I got my copies directly from you. You had a limited edition signed batch, so I had to get a couple of those.
Thank you.
And absolutely. If you're coming from the world of rock and roll, if you like the band, buy the CD, folks, because they didn't get paid at the door. If you like research like this, go buy the books that researchers write. That's literally what enables them to do more research. So, I love the fact that you have revised this book, added new things to it. What was it that brought you to write the book to begin with, Ken?
Well, Christopher, my genesis into investigating creatures like the Mothman and other flying humanoids goes back to when, as you know, I'm kind of a traditional old school cryptozoologist in terms of, you know, try to keep it straight zoology. And so,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of how it was intended to be. But about 25 years ago, when I was living in San Antonio, when I first moved to San Antonio and just before that, I began researching accounts of winged cryptids throughout South Texas. Many of my Texan friends will be familiar with the Big Bird. Yes, a play on the Sesame Street character, but the creature that was described down there in the Rio Grande Valley and parts of San Antonio, yep, starting in 1975, 76, was, you know, this winged creature. Some said it was bat-like or more like a flying pterosaur, like a winged reptile type thing. Very dragon-like. Some people said it was just an enormous bird. But anyways, all of those things kind of fall within the purview of traditional cryptozoology. But shortly after I came out with that book, I appeared on an episode of the old show Monster Quest. And then the following year, they called me up. The producers called me and said, hey, would you like to go down to Mexico and investigate kind of a Mothman case that's developing down there? This was in 2009. And of course, I was like, wow, that, you know, I was weaned on the Mothman as a kid. Of course, my mom used to regale me with stories of the West Virginia Mothman. And I read John Keel's books when I was a kid and all that kind of stuff. So it's always been a fascinating mystery to me. So we went down to Mexico in 2009, filmed the episode, mostly around Monterrey, and interviewed some eyewitnesses who claimed that they'd seen, you know, winged human-like creatures. And then ultimately I ended up, you know, doing another show up in Point Pleasant. Finally got a chance to go up there and investigate the original Mothman in 2010 or 11. And, of course, once you're on TV talking about these things, ultimately people will reach out to you that have had experiences, which is what happened. I was contacted by a number of people who, you know, wanted to basically unburden themselves. They'd seen these weird, winged, human-like creatures, certainly nothing that we consider traditional within the field of cryptozoology, but very strange. And so ultimately through the years, I've interviewed many eyewitnesses. I've investigated these winged humanoid creatures, you know, kind of in addition to my traditional cryptozoology stuff. And I guess as we get into it a little bit, well, it will be clear that I view this as definitively a metaphysical or supernatural construct or phenomenon, something that folks that are in the UFO field with you or, you know, in different aspects of the paranormal field will relate to, because it's certainly, again, the Mothman. You know, from the outset, let's say it, the Mothman does not match anything that should have evolved on this planet.
Yeah.
Its behaviors were very unnatural. And there was a lot of weird stuff attached to it, from psychic phenomenon to UFOs, to men in black, to curses and all this kind of stuff. So it's a pretty weird and fascinating case and very, very dark and creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. And one that, like you said, literally struck terror into a town for a while, especially just before the Silver Bridge collapse, which is, of course, most famously what the Mothman is connected to. But let's get into a little bit of that lore and the cases that led up to that event, Ken, before we get into modern day sightings, things like that.
Well, the quintessential Mothman encounter occurred on the just before midnight on November 14th, 1966. There were two young married couples, Roger and Linda Scarberry, Steve and Mary Mallett, were cruising around in their old 57 Chevy around an area known as the TNT plant or TNT area, which is just next to Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Point Pleasant is a little city, town, right on the Ohio River, on the border with Ohio, kind of a very rural area, still kind of the same after all these years. But the TNT area nearby was so named because during World War II, it had been used as an ammunition manufacturing and storage facility. It's littered with about 100 of these concrete bunkers that are reinforced and covered with grass and dirt, so they're not visible from the air, and they would store explosives in there. And then after World War II, the place was used for storing toxic chemicals and other things. But As is the case in rural areas, many of the young people would use it as kind of a lover's lane or a hangout place where they would go and party and stuff. And so the Mallets and Scarberries were driving around looking for something to do just before midnight. And as they approached this old building called the North Power Plant, the women saw it first, you know, what is that? And, you know, according to all four witnesses, what they saw was a man-like figure about 6.5 to 7 feet tall, they estimated. Of course, its most startling features were these big red hypnotic eyes that kind of transfix them, kind of seem self-illuminating. It did have wings attached to its back, and it had sturdy man-like legs. The head was kind of low slung, so they couldn't tell if it had a head. The eyes are kind of placed down here, if you will. And this thing waddled off towards the abandoned power plant building in a very clumsy fashion. Of course, they were terrified after a few minutes of being transfixed. They decided to tear off out of there. And then they claimed they saw this thing again on the top of a hill. It took off and chased them all the way back to town for several miles at speeds approaching 100 miles an hour, flying just above and beyond the car and then bumping into the side of the car. Mary Mallett, who's in the back seat. The ladies were in the back seat. The gents were in the front. Roger Scarberry was driving. Mary Mallett claimed she could hear this thing making a mechanical squeaking noise. And then just before town, when they were getting into the kind of the lights of the outside of town, the thing disappeared. Well, of course, they were in shock, didn't know what to do. They thought about going to the police, but they didn't think anyone would believe them, frankly. So they drove to Tiny's Drive-In, which is on the outskirts of Point Pleasant, which was just about to close right before midnight. They knew some people that worked there, and they talked to some people there, and they convinced them, hey, call the police. So a guy named Deputy Millard Halstead showed up and led them back, hesitantly back to the to look for this thing. And I'm leaving out another possible sighting when they went back, maybe on the fringe of town. But they didn't see it when they got out there. There was a mysterious cloud of dust. The police officer's radio seemed to go out of control and was garbled, you know, garbled messages like a phonograph, you know, or something, playing backwards. And it was just, you know, lots of weirdness. Well, ultimately, Mary Mallett and Linda Scarberry were in shock. Both ladies had to be taken to the hospital and evaluated for panic and PTSD. And then the four couples were obviously had a restless night where they kind of camped together. But, you know, the following morning, the sheriff, George Johnson, announced this encounter. It should be noted that the law enforcement officials that interviewed these couples knew them. You know, it's a small town.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody. They knew them to be, you know, sober, clean, you know, pretty straight-laced kids, and that they were very, very terrified by something. So that was the original story. And it was picked up by the local news wires, of course, or national news wires. And the name Mothman was not immediate. It was referred to as the bird monster, the Mason County bird. People just assumed, foregone conclusion, that they saw some kind of monstrous bird of some type. But that was the essential, quintessential sighting. The following night, a woman named Marcella Bennett had a very close encounter with this thing rising up behind her car near the TNT area. And, you know, after that, of course, a mass hysteria ensued, and people were going out to this TNT area in droves with, you know, guns and pitchforks and baseball bats,
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah,
trying to find this creature. And the local officials had to, you know, do some crowd management. And so that was it. And then there was, you know, there were a number of sightings, you know, and we could talk about those for about the course of a year until the tragedy of the Silver Bridge collapse, which occurred, you know, exactly, pretty much exactly 13 months after that, on December 15th, 1967.
And that is what many people attribute the Mothman to, is kind of a harbinger being that shows up. Because it's not like there was any pre-existing lore before that, any sightings before that in the area, anything like that, correct?
Yes. The fact that the Mothman sightings really kind of stopped occurring right around the time the bridge collapsed, or right before that, many people do associate the Mothman with the tragedy of the Silver Bridge collapse. And a lot of that was that idea was kind of initiated by John Keel, author of the Mothman Prophecies, who we just mentioned, and also a colleague of his named Gray Barker, who was a UFO author who wrote a book called The Silver Bridge in 1970. And he was probably the first one to publicly link those things. And then John Keel did as well. If we talk about some of these similar creatures in antiquity, which I'm happy to do.
Yes.
There are traditions of winged human-like creatures being considered harbingers or omens of cataclysmic events and things like that.
Let's do get into that for a second, because I think that's important to kind of cusp on before I bring up my next question. So,
An example, an old example would be Pazuzu, which was an Assyrian, the winged demon in Assyrian, you know, mythology.
Pazuzu.
Yeah. That's Pazuzu. You got your Zuzu on. That was, what was that, 3,000 years ago,
yep,
or something? You know,
yep.
2,500, 3,000 years ago, the ancient Assyrians had Pazuzu, which was typically depicted as, in your figurine, as a human-like form with a dog head, four wings, and typically his right hand is up in this position. Like a lot of mythological beings, Pazuzu had a duality in nature. It was considered to be a harbinger or omen of, you know, famine, pestilence, bad weather, and things like that. occasionally Pazuzu could also be a hero if he was driving another evil force into the underworld or whatever. But that's a very old example. And then, yeah. You know, in more modern times, you have, for example, in Irish and Scottish folklore, you have the Banshee and Scree, respectively. And those are also winged creatures that are said to appear right before a tragedy. There's an old story from the Battle of Culloden Moor. You know, hundreds of Jacobite soldiers were slaughtered right after this winged creature supposedly flew over, this Scree flew over the battlefield. And then, as you know, in like in Mexican Texas folklore, we have things like Lechuza, which is a shape-shifting witch, and owls in general. In many cultures, the appearance of an owl outside the window is considered to be, you know, a premonition of death or illness.
Yep. Same with hearing an owl hoot.
Yeah. So there are these recurring themes of winged harbingers that appear in the sky. Now, there are some that have to be kind of discounted. In the movie The Mothman Prophecies, which came out in 2002, a lot of folks have seen that with Richard Gere and Laura Linney. You know, they make mention of a Mothman-like figure appearing before the Chernobyl nuclear accident, the Black Bird of Chernobyl. Mm. Now, that was completely made up for the movie, but has kind of become ingrained into the Mothman mythology to the point where a lot of people now believe that that happened. Other fictional accounts are a Mothman-like creatures being seen before 9/11, before the towers collapsed, or before a great hurricane in Galveston, and those types of stories. So a lot of those we have to kind of take with a grain of salt. But there is an underlying theme or current or motif of things like Mothman appearing before a tragedy.
Interesting. And of course, you know, the very long history of protectorate beings that are winged, like gargoyles, things like that.
The Apkallu in ancient Sumerian mythology, and gargoyles, you're right. Mm. Again, it's that duality of nature. So, you know, Garuda in Hindu and Buddhist mythology. Sometimes they are enemies, demons to be feared. Other times they can be protectors or helpers.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, even the interesting case right up there where you're at now, the Jersey Devil. You know, whenever you start looking at that and the concepts behind that, the lore behind that is totally different, with somebody being cursed by a witch, all kinds of things, and the offspring becoming what the Jersey Devil is. But when you're talking about winged humanoids that are stalking people by night, that's right up there in that same neck of the woods.
Yeah, I did include the Jersey Devil in the book. Admittedly, it's not the most humanoid-looking creature based on the archetypal descriptions. You kind of nailed the story, the legend, back in 1735. Supposedly, a Mother Leeds, who was this poor destitute woman that lived in the Pine Barrens of southern New Jersey, she already had 12 children, and she became pregnant with a 13th, and she was a widow or something like that. So basically, when she gave birth to this 13th child, she cursed it, and it spawned wings and turned into this horrible monster. So there you've got a nice illustration there of the Nelson Evans sighting of the Jersey Devil, which occurred on January 9th, 1909. According to Mr. and Mrs. Nelson Evans, they watched this creature gallivanting on the roof of their shed for several minutes. They said it was about 3.5 feet tall, kangaroo-shaped body with long legs, bat-like wings, a long head or muzzle, glowing eyes. Some Jersey Devil eyewitnesses also described, you know, horns. And, of course, it had this long tail, like a forked tail, kind of like a devil's tail. So that's the kind of a chimera or a gargoyle, which you just mentioned. But there are a lot of similarities, I feel, between the Jersey Devil mythos and things like Mothman, because you did have, you know, first of all, you have an impossible creature. That's the first thing, with wings flitting about. And then many of the encounters are hyper-aggressive. According to one account, the Jersey Devil melted some railroad tracks when it blew fire on them. It attacked a trolley car full of people. It killed a dog. It was a very nasty sort of creature. And then you have all these weird elements associated with it, the stories of a curse and things of that nature. And you actually have a specific place kind of associated with it, too. You know, the Mothman, of course, is associated with the TNT area in Point Pleasant. The Jersey Devil is always seen in or around the Pine Barrens area of southern New Jersey in that forested area there. So,
and granted, and this was part of my question was, of course, could the Mothman be animal? And I have always posited that, you know, 1861 was when an American biologist categorized the hammer-headed bat.
Mm-hmm.
And it awful lot looks like a Jersey Devil, you know. Mm-hmm. So if he would have brought a sample back, a couple few samples back, something like that for study or anything like that, and they got loose, yeah, I mean, that's possible. Maybe not even probable, but possible to be able to explain the Jersey Devil, at least in the eyes of biology. What about Mothman?
No, that's a lot of people have brought up that weird striking similarity between a hammerhead bat and the Jersey Devil sketches. Yeah. The only thing I would argue against that, of course, is that the hammerhead bat is a very much a tropical equatorial species that lives in very warm environments. I doubt it would thrive during the winter in New Jersey.
Exactly.
But, you know, as with a lot of these cryptids and weird creatures, a lot of times we're dealing with a composite identity, meaning that there are different things that kind of get lumped together. So perhaps a misidentification of a known species is possible. One thing I like to point out about the Mothman, I just mentioned that it was referred to as the bird early on by the newspapers. And in fact, a local biology professor named Robert Smith, no, not the singer from The Cure, although that would have been cool, claimed that he thought the sightings were of a species known as a sandhill crane, which is Grus canadensis is the Latin name, which is a 5-foot-tall gray bird with a red blotch on its head. But very un-Mothman-like when you look at its long, skinny legs and long neck and stuff. But there is a history of Big Bird or Thunderbird sightings in West Virginia as well, Christopher.
Yeah.
I have an account from the 1890s from Webster County, West Virginia. According to stories, there was a giant eagle-like bird, very nasty and smelly, that was attacking livestock in that particular area and was ultimately dispatched by a farmer or rancher. And then in the 1920s, I have an account. I interviewed the grandson of a gentleman who claimed that he encountered a thunderbird in Mingo County, West Virginia, in the 1920s. He was riding a work detail in the back of a pickup truck on a logging road, and this giant, massive bird swooped down on him. So we have those accounts. So there is a tradition of Big Bird accounts in West Virginia already, and in Ohio, which is nearby. And then you also have one particular Mothman witness I'd like to reference is a guy named Thomas Ury, U-R-Y. On November 25th, 1966, 10 days after the Scarberry Mallet sighting, he had a daytime sighting of something as he was driving into Point Pleasant in the morning. And he was a young shoe salesman at the time, headed to work, and he claimed that this giant bird swooped over the trees and kind of like circled over his car, a few hundred feet in the air. And he said that it was like way larger than any bird that ever was known to exist, you know, 15, 20-foot wingspan. And he always stuck with that description, even up until the very end. In latter years, he was a speaker sometimes at the Mothman Festival in West Virginia, and he would always tell people, what I saw was not humanoid. It was a massive bird, unknown bird species of some kind. And he was actually a little bit ticked off at John Keel because John Keel had misrepresented his description in Mothman Prophecy's book and described it as a humanoid thing with big red glowing eyes. And he said, I never said any of that. And he felt like, Yeah, so he always wanted to kind of set the record straight that what he saw was definitively a monster bird. It was not a human. So we do have a little bit of,
That's
of
a
that
slight
ambiguity.
Discrepancy.
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a little we can bit talk, of a dip.
We can talk about that, too. As much as I admire John Keel and a lot of people love his book and his research, he was kind of found out to be a bit of a storyteller and embellisher in later years. Mm. So we have to keep that in mind when we read his books and his research.
Well, and you know, especially whenever you look at the fact of, I mean, he was a newspaper reporter. That's what he did for a living. So there is a way in which you write to sell newspapers, you know, where sure you're using fact and things like that, but there's also some conjecture in there as well. And if sometimes a healthy dose of conjecture to lead the reader along somewhere, you know,
that's true.
Mm-hmm. And that it is a specific style of writing. And yes, when applied to, and I wouldn't even necessarily say that he was quote researching, anything more than article material or anything like that. You know, I don't think he was on, I don't think he was a quote field researcher, in that kind of way, you know, definite investigative researcher, getting stories, compiling them, things like that. But once again, to add embellishment in order to sell.
Yeah, that's true. I never had the honor of meeting John Keel, and I'm certainly not here to disparage his reputation or anything, but I have spoken to people that did know him, and you know, he blamed a lot of that embellishment stuff on his editors. So sure. He said that, you know, it's a lot of times that was the case where they would go through and be editing the book and, well, let's touch the size. Not that dissimilar from a lot of the TV shows that we see now where the producers maybe step in and say, well, let's make this a little more interesting or exciting for the audience because it is ultimately entertainment.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So you kind of hit on a key point there. So the other thing we have to point out about Keel is, you know, he was obviously a very colorful person, personality. And he had a little bit of a confirmation bias because he was coming from more of a UFO background initially. And then he, you know, he also had some interest in demonology and different topics like that. Mm. He had kind of a Fordian view. If your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with Charles Fort, who kind of in the early 20th century authored many books about, you know, anomalous phenomenon. And, yeah, you know, the Fordian view is that, you know, all of these things might be interconnected somehow.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about UFOs or spirit phenomenon or cryptids or whatever. So there's still a lot of people that kind of view it that way. And, you know, I'm open-minded, but,
I love your open mind, especially as somebody who really comes at things and especially your research, from a very biological point of view, and scientific point of view. So it's one of those to hear you say, supernatural is interesting, Ken. It's fascinating to me to hear you resolve to the fact of like, this seems to be some kind of supernatural phenomena that is tied to the Mothman. So,
well, I certainly have a lot of colleagues that are, you know, do that kind of research. And,
absolutely.
So I think there's something to it. You know, what I often tell people when I'm discussing this kind of weird stuff is that, you know, I've seen a door slam by itself in a so-called haunted house in Jefferson, Texas. I've seen a black triangle UFO fly over Charles Mill Lake in Ohio back in 2004. So, I mean, those things, you know, in my mind, there's a valid phenomenon going on that, you know, warrants investigation. But I'm not necessarily about, you know, trying to find connections between these different things. I think all of these phenomena kind of stand alone in their own merits. You know, they kind of have a lot going for them.
Yeah.
But you know, the interesting aside here, Christopher, because I'm working on a new presentation I'll be doing this year called "The Sasquatch is an Undiscovered Species," and I do want to sort of challenge a lot of these ideas about Bigfoot UFO connections. And what I've found so far is that the very first reference that I can find is by John Keel in his 1970 book "Strange Creatures from Time and Space."
Wow.
He does a chapter on Bigfoot. And I think he calls it Abominable Swamp Slobs is the name of the chapter. Kind of funny. But he's the first one to suggest, hey, is there a connection between Bigfoot and UFOs? And then in 1972, just 2 years later, UFO researcher Jerome Clark and cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman co-authored an article in the Flying Saucer Review talking about Bigfoot and the possible Bigfoot UFO connection. And then the following year, in 1973, we had a flap of sightings in Pennsylvania, down there in like Westmoreland County and stuff, that, you know, investigated by Stan Gordon, some really weird Bigfoot UFO type cases. So I think that whole idea kind of spawned in the early 70s. And then, if you remember a lot of those UFO magazines from the 1970s, Christopher, a lot of them would put Bigfoot on the cover.
Fate magazine, you know? Things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just became, I think it became, because of that influence of a lot of that time period and a lot of those kind of early UFO publications and things, I think that's where that whole idea has kind of sprung from, because there's really not a lot of evidence that those two things are connected, in my opinion.
Well, and that is a topic that we've discussed before on the show, whenever we've had you and other researchers on, especially the very modern phenomena of Bigfoot and portals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and portals being seen with Bigfoot, things like that. So is it the idea of kind of cross contamination of sociologic memes that are going on? You know, and I that is not me calling Bigfoot a sociologic meme, people. perhaps the portal and the appearance of the portal, but not Bigfoot. Still always say, I believe that there is a large hominid species roaming the woods of North America and beyond, but there is something else that's there, you know. And once again, to hear you come to the point of saying, like, you don't think that there is any means by which Mothman could be animal.
Well, let's spin it around. I mean, the Mothman... Okay, here are the points of the Mothman. When I, at the outset, I said supernatural. So the physical description, we already mentioned, you know, it's a biological impossibility what was described by the eyewitnesses, the initial eyewitnesses, consistently. You know, even the wingspan of the Mothman, which was estimated at 10 feet across, that's not very big for something that stands 6.5 to 7 feet tall.
That's right.
So the physics just don't work, you know, how did this thing, and it didn't, you know, seem to have to get any inertia to fly. It just took off the ground and flew at these impossible speeds. So we got unnatural physical descriptions, behavioral descriptions. And then, moreover, there were some actual accounts of, in fact, many accounts of UFOs being seen in the sky above the TNT area for months after the Mothman sighting. Mm. I mentioned Marcella Bennett earlier, the second Mothman, well, really the fifth Mothman eyewitness, I should say. She and her brother were seeing this weird light in the sky as they were driving to this property where they ultimately encountered the Mothman a little while later. I've interviewed a woman named Linda Sigmund who claims that she and her boyfriend at the time had a UFO sighting near Point Pleasant and that they saw the Mothman pretty much come out of the UFO. John Keel and Mary Heyer, who was a local journalist who kind of joined forces with him, spent many nights at the TNT area in the early part of 1966 and claimed they saw many UFOs. So, and you know, we can go worldwide with this. I mean, there's sightings of UFOs in Mexico that have been associated with winged humanoid creatures and other places as well. So there's a definite inference of UFO activity or strange light phenomenon associated with creatures like the Mothman. And then we also have, you know, these stories of eyewitnesses. Linda Scarberry and Marcella Bennett both claim that they developed some psychic abilities after their Mothman sightings, ability of foresight and things like that. And then you have the weird phone calls and the men in black visitations.
Yep.
And
yep.
It's just a whole ball of weirdness when you get into this Mothman stuff. And so it really kind of, at least if you're open-minded to the idea of a supernatural or a metaphysical explanation, whatever that represents.
Yeah.
Some people are going to call it extraterrestrial. Some people say interdimensional. Some people say demonic. You know, the underlying message there is it's not a natural phenomenon from this planet or reality. It's something that's kind of manifesting or visiting us or something along those lines.
Passing through something like that. Which is frightening in and of itself. The idea of something coming through from another dimension and then passing on to another one.
Yes.
So, and it is interesting to, and there are numerous hypotheses about that, things like that. In modern science, we know that numerous dimensions now exist, all kinds of things. So, but whether or not they are occupied or even large enough to be occupied, who knows? But the idea of this supernatural thing once again coming and giving warning of something, and I don't know if it would necessarily be a warning, but being seen before disaster. I guess it would be warning if you see it again and see it again and see it again. Let's start getting into some of the modern sightings since the collapse of the bridge, Ken, especially other winged cryptid sightings here in America.
Yeah, well, of course, the most discussed winged humanoid flap since the Mothman incidents of the 1960s is the so-called Chicago Mothman that has been sighted up to 200 times since 2017, according to researchers that I've interviewed. I haven't really done a lot of work into that particular case, but I've known Lon Strickler with the Phantoms and Monsters website began funneling me some of the early reports in 2017. Now, what happened was on April 15th, 2017, MUFON, the branch of MUFON up there in Illinois, received three different reports of a giant flying creature on the night of April 15th and the morning of April 16th, 2017. And ultimately, those accounts, MUFON was not able to follow up because the original eyewitnesses were, apparently as elusive as Mothman himself at some point. But other web researchers like Lon Strickler and I can't think of his name, Christopher, but the gentleman at UFO Clearinghouse. Well, anyways, another popular website. And then people like Tobias Whalen from Wisconsin got involved, Alice Jordan. So many people around the Chicago area and also adjoining areas in Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin have claimed that they've seen this creature not that dissimilar from Mothman. Now, there is a lot of variation in terms of eyewitness descriptions from the accounts I've seen, but the most common description is a Mothman-like form, like a man-like figure with bat-like wings, standing about 6 feet tall, very slender build, and many people do describe the glowing eyes as well. There have been a number of sightings around the city of Chicago, which is surprising because it's obviously one of the largest cities in the country. And then we also have sightings allegedly around Chicago O'Hare Airport, right there on the edge of the city.
Yep.
By workers at the airport. Now what is worth noting is that there has not, to my knowledge, been any type of catastrophe or calamity that has occurred in Chicago since this creature started appearing in 2017. Yeah. So we do not have that, connection to make. But, there is something going on. And people that are interested in this, I do write about it in my book, The Essential Guide to Mothman and Other Flying Humanoids. It's a new addition to the book. But I also interviewed a gentleman named Tobias Whalen, who's written a book called The Lake Michigan Mothman. He's kind of broadened the range of this creature. And he rightfully pointed out to me that there is reason to be skeptical about some of the accounts. A lot of them can't be traced down properly. There haven't been proper interviews done. The descriptions are vague. And also there has been kind of a population explosion of large birds in the Chicago area for whatever reason since just before these sightings occurred.
Interesting.
Particularly great blue herons. They've really, wow. I guess, because they were driven out of other areas. So again, it's probably a composite identity thing. There may in fact be some kind of phantom creature at the root of these sightings, but no doubt there have also been misidentifications of large birds like herons and maybe just some made up fabricated stories that have kind of gotten thrown into the mix as well. But it is a pretty notable case in terms of the number of alleged eyewitnesses.
Well, and, especially that there is that continuing theme of the glowing eyes. And, it's interesting because they're, of course, in Sasquatch research, Bigfoot research, there is the idea of eye shine. And the idea that it's not like a cat or dog's cones in their eyes, or I guess rods in their eyes, that reflect the light back. It is a self-luminescence inside of the eye that is coming out.
Yes. And, the difference being, and of course, you're right, some people have described Bigfoot Sasquatches as having these eye shine or reflective eyes, typically a reddish color. But in terms of the Mothman, the eyes are, you know, very, very large in proportion to the body.
Yep.
2 inches wide, 6 inches apart. But multiple witnesses describe these eyes as having this hypnotic effect, mesmerizing thing where it kind of put them into a trance. And so presumably the eyes are very like, and they, some witnesses even describe them as being kind of pop eyes or poppy eyes, like protruding. So they definitely seem to be, you know, something different, you know, in terms of, you know, what we'd be used to in you know, like an eye shine on a particular type of nocturnal species. Is almost, again, it's just another element of that high strangeness.
Yeah.
You know, that supernatural aspect that these eyes, maybe they're not really eyes, you know, maybe they're people. Some people believe the Mothman is a mechanical thing, like other aliens have been, you know, I'm sure, you know, the Pasagula incident and the Flatwoods Monster. There have been many accounts of even the little grays. Some people think that they're robots, right? Yeah. They're not actual flesh and blood. So there's a lot of cool, you know, kind of trails that we can take on this subject matter.
Well, and you know, especially whenever you're talking of being supernatural, paranormal, it does leave a lot of trails open for investigation and for similarities in other cases. So it's especially when you're talking winged cryptids, because once again, they go back through history. So are there any native reports, anything like that, anything from the local indigenous population that would appear in their lore or history that would substantiate such a thing, Ken?
Well, I haven't found anything in West Virginia per se. There is a creature from a tribe up in Maine. I think it's the Potawatomi, but I can't remember exactly. But researcher Mark Hall talked about a flying head, basically, is what it's described as. It's like a disembodied head that with wings that flies around in the air. And, you know, that's kind of weird. But then you have, there's a tribe in Oklahoma that talk about like an owl man type creature, which there's actually an owl man in England that's been reported as well. There's a tribe in Alaska that also has a tradition of a half man, half owl that came down from the sky and, ended up living on this little isolated island. And I think also, if you look at some of the, Pueblos in New Mexico, there are some, Mothman type pictographs of like weird flying creatures that seemingly have that. So there's hints of it here in North America, Christopher, but I think, you know, you really have to look at the broader picture of different mythologies and folklores around the world to really, you know, build a case for these creatures in antiquity. Because, again, you have the ancient – we talked about the Assyrians and Sumerians. The ancient Greek had the harpies.
Yep.
Japan has something called the Tengu. In Mexico and Central America, there's something called Camasots or Sots, the death bat, which is like a man-like bat creature. And then there is even some modern stories of things like the Orang Bati or man bat from Indonesia, the Papa Bawa from Africa. So you really have to start, you know, looking at these things in a broad lens to look at all the worldwide legends. But as far as North America, I would say there are hints and traces, but not really a strong case for these creatures in that I've been able to uncover in different tribes. It's not like something like the Sasquatch or Thunderbirds, you know, where you have a lot of like really strong legends and traditions involving these creatures.
Interesting. Yeah. And I mean, of course, there's the Mayan bat god. who was Mambat.
Yeah.
And when you start looking at things like that, once again, that's really just about all you can lean on aside from the accounts that have been given. Because, like you said, it's not like we can find any kind of biology to base this on. The way that the creature itself is described, sketched, everything else, biologically should not work.
Yeah, those lineages, I mean, paleontologists trace back the lineage of birds to Archaeopteryx, which is one of the first ancestors of birds. That was a winged, it was a reptile that eventually became a bird, right? It was kind of a transitional thing. That was, about 150, 200 million years ago. Humans, and actually our ancestors now, they can trace back to little possum-like mammals that were running around during the Jurassic and Cretaceous, right? So we're talking about a split that occurred, 150, 200 million years ago, where, the lineage that was going to evolve into birds went this way, and we went that way along with other placental mammals, right? So there's no reason to think that evolution doesn't work in a way to where you would have these two ancient lineages separated by 150 million years would suddenly come together and you would have some kind of hybrid. Now, there are some other fun theories. Of course, we talk about mutations.
Sure.
The McClintic Wildlife Reserve, where the TNT area is located, has been labeled one of the 10 areas of greatest concern by the Environmental Protection Agency because of all these toxic chemicals that were being stored in these concrete bunkers for years and years. And there were some spills. There was an explosion in 2010. There was one of the bunkers exploded and they tested the water sample shortly after that and said, oh my God. So there are a lot of people there that think that the Mothman was some kind of science fiction mutation that, whether it's a bird or owl or something else that kind of rose up out of the toxic sludge. And then there's, you're always going to have that, element of, genetic manipulation. And is this some type of, top secret, is this something that was fabricated by the military or some secret organization? Are they playing with genetics and, creating kind of weird Island of Dr. Moreau types of hybrids? And another weird theory, Christopher, is that, the whole incident, at least the Mothman incident initially, was basically a government-controlled mind experiment where they basically fabricated this whole Mothman idea or put something out there to convince people in and around Point Pleasant that there was this monster. And there have been, I'm sure you've got some anecdotal stories on this too, but there have been examples of government and military entities around the world playing with the idea of creating a monster, right? The idea of a monster in order to create panic and mass hysteria or to control the population and stuff
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely.
So you get all these cool little, it's fun to speculate about. I mean, who knows?
Well, and I mean, one of the things that we've talked about on the show for years and years that just came out in the headlines is the fact that, like, the military and alphabet agencies for years have used stories and conflagrations of UFOs and things like that to cover up actual programs. So it's like, yes, feed the story of the UFO sighting, keep feeding it, stoke it, and make sure it's believed really well, because as long as that's believed, then we can keep working on this program over here and we aren't divulging anything.
Right.
So the idea of Mothman being some kind of super soldier program, it's interesting because especially out there in the cryptid communities, there are many a story of cryptid alphabet agency cooperation. People that are part of dogman units and Bigfoot hunting units, and Bigfoot helps them hunt and all kinds of things. So even the idea of Mothman being part of that, being or even being used as a beard by the alphabet agencies for some other type of experimentation upon the people of Point Pleasant, you know?
John Keel kind of, well, you know, if you write, his writings were a teeny bit paranoid, in my opinion. He kind of felt like he was being followed and all these things were going on. But Linda Scarbory, toward the very end, one of her last interviews, when she was asked, you know, what she thought the Mothman was, she said she thought the Mothman was basically a distraction that was invented to take everyone's attention away from the Men in Black. And she had all of these stories of people in and around Point Pleasant that had encountered these weird, you know, we're obviously not talking about Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones here, but something much more diabolical, which were very intimidating, seemingly non-human. You know, they're very pale. They speak in a weird dialect that no one understands. They wear sunglasses and fedoras and drive around in these vintage cars that are in pristine condition. You, most people that are into Fortiana will know the stories, but you know, that was her belief. And I think John Keel, to some extent, planted that idea in her head that there was something going on, like you said, something going on over here that involved these Men in Black, and that the Mothman was put out there as kind of a, you know, a distraction so people wouldn't notice what else was going on.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, once again, we definitely did that. Like there was a whole town in Canada that we held dose with LSD.
It wasn't you and me.
I would in no way, shape, or form be that wasteful with that much acid. But in all sincerity, you know, the idea that even the concept of mass hallucination, you know, the idea of a point of mass hysteria taking over a town to the point that people start having sightings, you know, there does become that psychological concept of once you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, you know?
Yeah. Well put.
And that's always something that we have to deal with this kind of investigation period. Whenever you're talking cryptozoological, parapsychological, UFO, UAP, it is one of those that things have to pass through a different filter of rigor, you know, in order to be called, quote, evidence in that kind of way.
Yeah, it's a very weird subject. Like I said, I'm far more comfortable running around in the woods looking for a 7.5 foot tall upright ape or skimming Loch Ness and looking for evidence of that. When you get into this kind of stuff, it's like, you know, but I want to underline this again, Christopher. I have interviewed many people who claim that they've encountered things like the Mothman, and these are very traumatic experiences.
Absolutely.
I mean, these people have been very affected in a very disturbing and profound way.
Yep.
I've had witnesses break down and start sobbing, you know, as they're telling their stories. It's been life-changing for others. They've had to immerse themselves in all kinds of books and, you know, just obsessively researching, trying to figure out what it was that they experienced. Why were they chosen? You know, a lot of these people have, you know, a lot of the original Mothman witnesses went into hiding. They, you know, were so traumatized by their experiences. Linda Scarbory was courageous and did interviews towards the end. Marcella Bennett would come out on occasion, but Stephen Mary Mallett pretty much disappeared. Didn't want to talk about it. My understanding is that Roger Scarbory, who has been silent for years and years, is finally resurfacing and saying that he wants to set the record straight and that something terrifying did happen to them. And even an eyewitness named Connie Jo Carpenter, who was almost abducted by Men in Black and had a Mothman sighting, which caused her eyes to swell up and she got conjunctivitis. She disappeared for years and years. And apparently she, from my contacts up there, she is now about to come forward again. So, you know, people just essentially these experiences, well, you can't even imagine. It's traumatic. It's a very chilling thing. And I don't care to encounter one of these things.
Yeah, no. And that's something, a caveat that I give to anybody. I mean, especially if you're out doing paranormal investigation, things, I am not somebody like, feel free to put an instrument out, but we don't need to be poking and prodding and asking questions. That invites something in a different way, you know, things like that. And it's strange, once again, the way that these things affect the human psyche when they happen. It opens a whole new keyhole through which you view things, and the ontologic shock of losing your reality, you know, the reality that you once knew to be no longer exists. Right. And that brings about questions of faith, that brings about all kinds of things that we ultimately intrinsically make up us, you know? Right. So it's like when one of these things happens to somebody, it's a massive shock to the system. And some people can't write that system, sadly. It affects lives. It affects families. Like you said, people go into hiding, all kinds of stuff. So the example I normally give is all the books behind me from guests who have had experiences. You know, they end like a Disney movie, but with understanding and great empathy for their experience, you know, but they also start like a Disney movie, which means it's a really, really horrible experience for one character in the story. Like, it's very traumatic, you know. So, yeah, it's one of those, like, be careful kind of what you wish for whenever you're out doing this kind of investigation, whenever you're looking for things, because you may have the experience that you're looking for, and it may not be a good one. Even most people that have seen Sasquatch, stuff like that, the initial response is absolute shock and fear. They may come to terms with things afterward, but the initial response is shock and fear, because it's absolutely just something that is totally different to the reality that your mind knows. So, I want to thank you for your time today, Ken. It's always great chatting with you. It's always great talking. I am looking forward to finishing. I got probably about a good halfway through the book before we had this conversation. So I want to say I left off shortly after the Tengu in there. So I am looking forward to finishing the rest of this. Where can people go? Because you've got cryptozoology classes that you put on online, all kinds of things. Where can people go to find everything that is King Gerhard? Where can they go to buy the new book? Where can they go to take classes from you? Let everybody know about everything, Ken.
Well, thank you again for having me on, Christopher. Always. It's always a great time speaking with you. People can just go to my website, kengerhard.com. There's a link where you can get more information about my online cryptozoology course, which covers a full range of topics. And I just did a class on the Mothman.
Oh, wow.
So that's brand new. And there's also now an online store where people can purchase copies of my books. It takes you to the Amazon links and so on and so forth. People can also contact me directly if they'd like a signed copy. I'm happy to do that. And I am visible on lots of social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, you know, all the, oh, and I also have a Patreon, Exploring Cryptozoology. If folks want to follow me on there, I've got exclusive content and stuff available. And that's also a great way to sign up for the online classes. So,
yeah, absolutely. I've been excited to see you. I have a certificate from Gerhard University.
You do. You're an honor student.
The only one that I've missed is the Mothman one, and it made me sad. I guess I was online and Anne was asking me something about it, and I was like, oh my gosh, I totally forgot that was happening today. I'm sad. I'm going to miss that. So I'm glad that went well and that the classes are going well and being received well, because I think it is important, especially in the world of cryptozoology, for people to understand that cryptozoology is a first part of zoology. You know, we first have to hypothesize these things are out there before we start searching for them. So even the idea of wondering and hypothesizing and questioning, that is a hugely important part of science. So
absolutely.
Thank you for all you do, Ken. Thank you for all of your amazing research. Bless you. And bless you. Thank you so much again for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience, buddy. While you are
gotcha.
While you are online checking out everything from Ken Gerhard over at kengerhard.com. Everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can find all of our various forms of social media, where you can share things, where you can comment, all kinds of stuff. Also, make sure to stop on by Curious Research. That is where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log if you are an investigator in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, or UFO, UAP, field research. Make sure to get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. It is your back pocket data log for everything that you experience in the field while out on investigations or while taking experiencer reports. So thank you so much, everybody, for your time. As always, thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.